Welcome back to the Journal Review. This is your walkthrough of the February 2026 issue of Dermatologic Surgery, and we've got four pieces worth your time today. A population-based epidemiology study on cutaneous leiomyosarcoma, a retrospective cohort study looking at pulse dye laser as a chemopreventive tool against keratinocyte carcinoma, a reconstructive conundrum case involving a multi-subunit nasal and cheek defect, and a systematic review that tries to bring some order to the chaotic nomenclature around tacking sutures. Let's get into it. First up is an original article, a retrospective population-based analysis using the Surveillance, Epidemiology, and End Results Database, SEER, looking at cutaneous leiomyosarcoma, or LMS. The clinical problem here is one you already sense in practice. Leiomyosarcoma of the skin is subdivided into dermally-based tumors, thought to arise from erector pili muscle, and subcutis-based tumors, thought to arise from vascular smooth muscle within fat. The World Health Organization has actually proposed renaming the purely dermal-confined variant atypical intradermal smooth muscle neoplasm to reflect its generally indolent behavior, though that's contested since some dermal tumors do metastasize. The existing literature is thin, mostly single-center series under 100 patients, and often without a clean split between dermal and subcutaneous disease, which muddies any conclusions about prognosis and risk factors. A prior SEER analysis existed, but was limited to about 200 patients, all dermal. So the gap here is a properly powered, stratified population-level look at both subtypes side by side. Methodologically, the authors pulled patients from SEER 17 registries from 2000 to 2021, using histology codes for leiomyosarcoma and separating dermal versus subcutaneous origin by topography codes. A retrospective registry design is really the only feasible way to study a tumor this rare. You'd never accrue enough cases prospectively at a single center, and SEER gives you national population-level incidence data you simply can't get otherwise. They calculated age-adjusted incidence rates, used Kaplan-Meier estimates for disease-specific and overall survival, and built Cox proportional hazards models for prognostic factors, using ACOG information criteria to guide covariate selection and multiple imputation to handle missing tumor size data. Grade was captured using the SEER recode that maps onto the standard French Federation grading scheme used for sarcomas. On to results. They identified about 1,100 patients with dermal disease and a little over 7,000 with subcutaneous disease, so subcutaneous LMS is roughly 6 to 7 times more common. Incidence was about 0.6 of a case per million person years for dermal tumors versus almost 4 per million for subcutaneous tumors. Dermal disease showed a strong male predominance, nearly 4-1, while subcutaneous disease was roughly even between sexes. And here's the number that really matters clinically. 5-year disease-specific survival for dermal LMS was about 97%, essentially excellent, while 5-year disease-specific survival for subcutaneous LMS was only around 63%, a dramatic and clinically enormous gap. 10-year numbers held that pattern, 95% versus 55%. Subcutaneous tumors were also far larger on average, over 7 centimeters versus under 2 centimeters for dermal tumors, and were much more likely to present with distant stage disease or higher grade histology. On prognostic factors, some things predicted worse survival in both subtypes. Advanced age, particularly 75 and older, female sex, head and neck location, distant stage of diagnosis, and household income under $75,000. For dermal disease specifically, distant stage carried an enormous hazard, roughly a 30-fold increase in risk of disease-specific death, which is a striking number even though absolute events were rare. Age over 75 carried about a 4-fold increased hazard, and head and neck location nearly a 4-fold increased hazard relative to limb disease. Interestingly, for dermal tumors, neither tumor grade, tumor size, nor margin width, narrow versus wide excision, significantly affected disease-specific survival, even in sensitivity analyses restricted to head and neck tumors. For subcutaneous disease, tumor size behaved very differently and mattered a great deal. Tumors 3-6 centimeters carried roughly double the hazard of death, 6-10 centimeters roughly quadrupled it, and tumors over 10 centimeters carried about a 6-fold increased hazard. A clean, clinically meaningful dose-response relationship. Grade 2 and 3 disease also predicted worse outcomes in the subcutaneous group specifically. One genuinely counterintuitive finding: among subcutaneous LMS patients with localized disease, receiving radiation or chemotherapy was associated with worse, not better, disease-specific survival. The authors don't fully unpack this, but this is almost certainly confounding by indication. Clinicians are more likely to recommend adjuvant therapy for tumors they perceive as higher risk, and registry data can't fully capture that selection process. Chemotherapy did show a modest survival benefit, but only in patients presenting with distant stage disease already. The discussion frames this as the largest population-based study of its kind, confirming that dermal LMS behaves almost like a different disease than subcutaneous LMS, reassuringly indolent in the former, aggressive in the latter. Limitations are the usual registry constraints. No central pathology review, no data on margin status for subcutaneous tumors, substantial missingness in grade, over two-thirds of dermal cases lacked grade data, and no ability to distinguish local recurrence from de novo disease. Confounding by indication around adjuvant therapy is a real weakness, given how it inverts the expected treatment-benefit relationship. What should you actually take from this? The practice-changing piece is the message about margins. For dermal LMS, this dataset found no survival benefit to wide versus narrow margin excision, and tumor size didn't predict death either, which supports a Mohs appropriate, tissue-sparing surgical approach for dermal disease without extending margins reflexively for larger dermal tumors, provided histologic clearance is achieved. For subcutaneous LMS, the size thresholds are worth internalizing for counseling and staging conversations. Tumors crossing 3, 6, and 10 centimeters mark meaningfully escalating risk categories, and head and neck location, older age, and lower income all flag patients who deserve closer surveillance. The adjuvant therapy findings are interesting, but not actionable. They almost certainly reflect selection bias rather than true harm from treatment. So don't let that finding change your referral pattern for adjuvant therapy in high-risk subcutaneous disease. Second article, another original study, a retrospective cohort out of Massachusetts General Hospital's Laser Center, asking whether pulsed dye laser treatment reduces the risk of subsequent keratinocyte carcinoma in patients who already have a history of facial keratinocyte carcinoma. The background here is straightforward. Keratinocyte carcinomas are extraordinarily common. Incidence keeps climbing despite sunscreen and field therapies, and patients with one prior keratinocyte carcinoma are roughly 10 times more likely to develop another. Non-ablative and ablative fractional lasers have shown some chemopreventive signal in prior work, and pulse dye laser is already used to treat existing basal cell carcinomas, but nobody had studied pulse dye laser specifically as a preventive tool. Methodologically, this is a retrospective cohort built from an electronic query of their laser center's records, cross-referencing diagnosis codes for facial basal or squamous cell carcinoma with documentation of pulse dye laser treatment. Brand name searches for the device were even used to catch treatments. A retrospective design makes sense here for essentially the same reason as the sarcoma study. You're not going to randomize patients to laser versus no laser for cancer prevention. So mining an existing longitudinal laser registry is the pragmatic way to generate a preliminary signal. They matched 59 pulse dye laser treated patients to 59 controls by age and sex, explicitly excluding anyone treated for vascular lesions, port wine stains, scars, or bruising, and excluding anyone with predisposing conditions like organ transplant or genetic cancer syndromes, to isolate the effect in an otherwise average keratinocyte carcinoma-prone population. Time zero was set at the first pathology-confirmed facial keratinocyte carcinoma, and follow-up ran to either a new biopsy-proven lesion or the most recent total body skin exam. They used log-rank tests and a POX model adjusting for age, sex, and Fitzpatrick skin type. The result? New facial keratinocyte carcinoma developed in about 27% of pulse dye laser treated patients compared with 54% of controls, essentially a halving of risk, and that was statistically significant. After adjusting for age, sex, and skin type, the protective association held, with controls carrying roughly a threefold higher hazard of developing a new lesion compared to treated patients. Average follow-up was long, over 8.5 years, which adds some confidence that this isn't just a short-term artifact. Subgroup analyses within the treated group found no significant difference in protection by sex, by number of treatments received, or by Fitzpatrick skin type. Notably, benefit was seen even after just a single treatment. In their discussion, the authors proposed several plausible mechanisms: selective photothermolysis of the vascular supply feeding early neoplastic change, alterations in local cytokine signaling, and mechanisms shared with other water chromophore devices like reduction of ultraviolet damaging. P53 mutant keratinocyte clones, and modulation of insulin-like growth factor 1 signaling relevant to DNA repair. they frame pulse dye laser as an attractive option compared to topical field therapies like 5-fluorouracil or imiquimod, because it's a brief, well-tolerated procedure with decades of safety data and no risk of the irritation or non-adherence that undermines long-term topical regimens. Now, limitations, which the authors don't dwell on, but you should. This is a small cohort, 59 and 59, from a single academic laser center, so selection bias is a real concern. Patients referred for pulse dye laser at a cosmetic center may differ systematically from typical keratinocyte carcinoma patients in ways that matter, including reasons for referral, skin type distribution, or general engagement with dermatologic surveillance. It's retrospective and observational, so this is an association, not proof of causation. And there's no clear dose-response signal here, since number of treatments didn't matter, which is a little at odds with a true biological chemopreventive effect, and could instead reflect confounding. Practically speaking, this is an intriguing, hypothesis-generating finding, not yet practice-changing. It's not something to start recommending to patients as a proven skin cancer prevention strategy, but it's a reasonable rationale to keep in your back pocket. If you're already using pulse dye laser for vascular or scar indications in a keratinocyte carcinoma-prone patient, you might mention there's an emerging, though preliminary, secondary benefit. It's worth watching for a larger, ideally multicenter replication before it changes any counseling in a meaningful way. Third piece is a reconstructive conundrum, essentially a case-based technique discussion rather than a data study. So we'll walk it the way it's actually built. Presentation, reasoning, technique, outcome. An 89-year-old woman had an infiltrative basal cell carcinoma of the left nasal ala, cleared after 3 stages of Mohs surgery, leaving a 4x2.5 cm defect spanning the nasal ala, nasal sidewall, and medial cheek. A genuinely multi-subunit problem. The author's reasoning is the real value here. Primary closure was off the table, given size and location. Secondary intention or grafting were rejected because of the risk of free margin distortion and external nasal valve collapse, a legitimate concern given the ala's lack of underlying cartilaginous support. Rather than trying to cover the whole defect with a single flap, which they note would have blurred cosmetic subunit boundaries and produced visible asymmetry, they split the repair conceptually into 2 subunits, medial cheek and nasal ala plus sidewall. For the cheek component, they talk through why they passed on a cheek advancement flap, insufficient coverage and risk of pulling the upper lip free margin, and a cervicofacial rotation flap, too much undermining and long incision lines across the cheek. They landed on a VY advancement flap, which pulls tissue from the lateral and inferior cheek while hiding its incisions within the melolabial fold and along resting skin tension lines superolaterally. They note the classic risk of trapdoor deformity with this flap and describe mitigating it through slight undersizing of the flap and generous undermining of the surrounding recipient skin. For the nasal component, they needed a cartilage graft, harvested from the ear's anti-hilex, to restore structural support to the ala and protect nasal valve patency. That's a non-negotiable step whenever you're reconstructing a deep alar defect lacking native cartilage. They discuss the melolabial interpolation flap as the usual workhorse for alar defects, but note the cheek reservoir wasn't available in this case. So they turned to a paramedian forehead flap instead, a reliable alternative for larger nasal defects. During inset, they used a periosteal tacking stitch to recreate the alar facial sulcus, and at the 3-week takedown, they placed a basting suture under the flap along the alar groove to preserve that concavity, a technique nicely relevant to our 4th article today. A temporary petrolatum gauze nasal plug was used postoperatively to guard against valve insufficiency from edema and anesthetic effects on the intrinsic dilator muscles. At 6 months, the patient had normal nasal valve function and a good cosmetic result. The teaching points here are clean. Large defects crossing multiple cosmetic subunits are best approached as separate reconstructive problems rather than one heroic flap. A well-designed VY advancement can minimize trapdoor deformity through undersizing and undermining, and basting or tacking sutures are essential tools for recreating the alar groove concavity when using interpolation flaps like the paramedian forehead flap. Which brings us naturally to our 4th article, a systematic review attempting to standardize the terminology around exactly this kind of tacking suture. The problem they identify is real and one you've probably run into reading the literature yourself. Terms like tacking, pexing, quilting, basting, suspension, and contouring get used inconsistently, sometimes interchangeably, sometimes to mean entirely different things, which muddies reproducibility when you're trying to replicate a described technique. Methodologically, they followed PRISMA guidelines, searching 5 major skin surgery journals plus Medline, using 8 different search terms for tacking tight sutures, each paired with reconstruction. That search returned nearly 1,500 articles, which, after removing duplicates and screening out papers that use the terms loosely without actually describing a fixation technique, narrowed down to 98 included articles. 2 authors independently categorized each described technique by the name the original authors gave it, by the actual tissue fixation technique used, and by its functional purpose. This is a fairly standard systematic review process for a terminology or classification project. You're not pooling outcomes data, you're synthesizing descriptive categories, so PRISMA screening rigor substitutes for the meta-analytic statistics you'd see in an efficacy review. The result is a genuinely useful framework. They identified 4 distinct tissue fixation techniques: quilting, which is percutaneous tacking down to cartilage, periosteum, or soft tissue, most familiar as the basting suture used to secure full-thickness skin grafts or cartilage batten grafts; pexing, the most commonly described technique, which anchors the undersurface of a flap or wound edge to a deeper structure like periosteum or perichondrium; superficial plane fixation, a newly proposed term for sutures that lift tissue to a more superficial plane, as in restoring internal nasal valve patency, or the classic Frost suture anchoring the lower eyelid tarsus to the brow; and plication, which approximates fascial or periosteal tissue within the same plane, as in SMAS or galial plication for large cheek and scalp defects, or lateral canthal tendon plication for canthapexy. Layered onto that, they identified 4 functional descriptors: suspension, which offloads tension from a wound edge by anchoring it to a stable point like periosteum; contour, which prevents tenting across a concavity, like recreating the alar crease or nasofacial sulcus; guide, which orients healing along a desired tension vector for second intention healing; and wound reduction, a catch-all for sutures that simply shrink a defect size before repair, like SMAS plication before a rotation flap. Their proposed solution is a binomial nomenclature, combining a fixation technique term with a function term. So, for instance, a suture tacking a cheek flap's undersurface to maxillary periosteum to recreate the nasofacial sulcus becomes a pexing contour, or PC suture. It's a clean, logical system, and notably it's exactly the language that would have applied to the basting sutures used in the reconstructive case we just covered. That alar groove tacking stitch is a textbook pexing contour suture. There's no results versus limitations arc here in the traditional sense, since this is a classification proposal rather than an outcome study, but it's worth flagging as a practical writing and communication tool. This won't change how you operate tomorrow, but it's genuinely useful for how you describe your own techniques in publications or teaching. Adopting consistent binomial terminology when you write up cases could meaningfully improve reproducibility across the literature, and it's a nice one to keep on hand next time you're drafting a technique paper of your own. That wraps our 4 articles for this issue. To summarize the actionable versus the merely interesting, the leiomyosarcoma data meaningfully refines how you risk stratify and counsel patients by dermal versus subcutaneous origin, and supports margin conservative surgery for dermal disease. The pulsed dye laser prevention data is a promising but preliminary signal, not yet ready to drive clinical recommendations. The reconstructive case is a nice technical refresher on subunit-based planning for complex nasal cheek defects. And the tacking suture review is a useful vocabulary upgrade for your own writing, rather than a change to how you operate.